This is Writer's Cast, a podcast about books and authors. I'm your host, David Wilk. Today, I'm talking to Tom McNamee. He's the author of a book called The Inner Life of Cats, The Science and Secrets of Our Mysterious Feline Companions. How are you, Tom?
I'm very well, David. Thank you.
Oh, it's really good to talk to you. Now, you and I know each other from an experience of working together on a book that I really liked a lot about the wolves of Yellowstone. And, you know, I know a bit about you, but I think that it would be good for you to talk a little bit about your history as a writer because you've done so many different things. I think it would be really nice to hear kind of the evolution of your work as a writer and you know, in a summary form.
Sure. Well, my father, who's from the Mississippi Delta, always said, Tommy, you're a mile wide and an inch deep. that probably does describe me pretty well. I grew up in Memphis, and I went to Yale, and there I studied under Robert Penn Warren, who's a big influence on my life. And I mainly wrote poetry. I was what was called a scholar of the house, which gave me my entire senior year to just work on whatever I wanted to do. And I wrote poetry then. And on graduating, I continued to write poetry. I was working for Columbia Records. I produced one of the lowest selling records in Columbia history, Hampton Grease Band. It took me quite a while to struggle forward to do. I failed and failed and failed, basically, at the beginning. I tried to write a totally insane play, musical play, and I couldn't write music, so I had a composer partner. And we spent 5 years failing to get that on Broadway. We even had Leonard Bernstein for a mentor, and his sister was our manager, but it was a disaster. And then I went on to write short stories that were too long to fit in any magazine. And eventually I discovered ecology. And my poetry had been trending toward writing about how things fit together. And I'd always loved the outdoors anyway. And I discovered Yellowstone. I stumbled on a grizzly bear footprint one day and huge thing as big as a dinner plate. I was backpacking, and I went to, and I found a guy outside the park after that trip, and asked him about tell me about grizzly bears in Yellowstone. And he said, "Well, they're going extinct." And so, oh my God, that's terrible. And I then proposed to Audubon Magazine that I would write an article about grizzly bears of Yellowstone, and I did. And it was long, 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 way too long, but they liked it anyway, and they put it on the cover. And that attracted a literary agent, and then that evolved into my first book at long last. I was well into my 30s, The Grizzly Bear. And I continued to write poetry and publish poetry, but then this led to my writing in the field of natural history and having a deep, resonant relationship with the Yellowstone ecosystem. I became involved not only in writing about it, but also in the conservation of Yellowstone. I was on the board of the Greater Yellowstone Coalition. I eventually became its chairman. And I wrote a book called The Return of the Wolf to Yellowstone. I also wrote a novel called The Story of Deep Delight, which was my thank you to Robert Penn Warren. That was one of the final words of his great poem, Audubon. And it was my way of thanking him. That was set in where I grew up. And I wrote a book of conservation philosophy called Nature First, subtitled Keeping Our Wild Places and Wild Creatures Wild. I'm probably going to forget some of these books, but somewhere along the line, I was on the board of another conservation group called RARE. And RARE was interested. Well, I learned at RARE that there was more biodiversity in the world on farms than in all the nature reserves and national parks and so forth all over the world. And so I began to develop an interest in agriculture. And through that, I ran across Alice Waters and her restaurant, Chez Panisse in Berkeley, which was and still is, I think, considered the best restaurant in the United States. And Alice was and is probably the singular leader of the organic food movement, organic farming and so forth. And I realized that my interest in, I'd always loved to cook, and my interest in food and my interest in nature conservation had a kind of crossroads right there. And that led me to write a book called Alice Waters and Chez Panisse, which is both a biography of Alice and a history of the restaurant with an emphasis on its role in conservation and the role of food in global biodiversity conservation. And by hook and crook, that led me to, well, in 2008, when the whole economy was tanking, my agent said, I wanted to do something else. I was been working on a memoir for years, kind of a comical memoir called Tom No Eat Bone. And I wanted to publish that next. And both my publisher and my agent said, Tom, you're not a drug addict. You're not famous. Your father didn't beat you when you were a kid, so forget the memoir, but maybe we can sell a biography or something about food. And so I did a biography about food, a biography of Craig Claiborne, who was the first food editor of the New York Times and who really introduced the United States to the world of food, that is, the world outside the United States, French food, Italian food, Vietnamese food, Indian food, and really created our modern food world as we know it. And then what did I do next? I guess that probably brings me to you, David. When I decided to try to extract one of the stories from The Return of the Wolf to Yellowstone that I felt was important for people to know, because the memory of the reintroduction had already begun to fade, particularly in the region, and children were growing up enveloped in falsehoods about the wolves. There was a fantastic success. The wolves had done brilliantly. The population had burgeoned, and they had altered the ecosystem in many ways, and they're doing beautifully, but the nasty politics of the Yellowstone region, Idaho, Montana, and Wyoming, were leading children to grow up believing that the wolves were the epitome of evil, as had so often been myth in Western civilization for hundreds, thousands of years. And I felt that by extracting this story and dramatizing it, that would be a way of bringing the story back to life, and in particular, reaching young people in the region. So I extracted the story of the killing of Wolf Number 10, who was one of the originals, and he and his mate, Number 9, created had a litter of pups that before he died, was shot by an idiot. Those pups became the progenitors of much of today's wolf population in Yellowstone. And that finally, you know, sticking along the animal line, I realized that I had a great interest in cats. I had a cat that I loved and loved, named Augusta, who was abandoned in our driveway when my wife and I lived on a ranch in Montana, and proved to be my bosom companion for 15 years and died. And we didn't know very much about raising a cat, and we didn't do a very good job of it. And looking back, I realized that the amazingly fascinating animal she had been. And as I began to look into how cats see the world, I thought there was a book there. And that became The Inner Life of Cats, my current book.
So in this book, I mean, in the book is sort of structured around the personal experience. It is almost like a literary memoir. You know, you start with Augusta, and then that takes you into all of these kind of almost, I don't want to say encyclopedic, but it is a pretty broad exploration of cat life, and which touches on a pretty large number of cat related subjects.
Yeah, my idea was to try to absorb all this fantastic scientific literature about cats that has not reached the public at large. I mean, you can type cat into the search bar on Amazon.com and you'll get thousands of cat books. But very, almost none of them really reflect what is now known about cats that's been developed by serious scientists. And so most of the information that's been out there in the public, before the public, about cats is way out of date. And so I saw a fantastic opportunity to, you know, take this basically incomprehensible scientific stuff, and through Augusta's life, where you know, her various experiences drew on what has been learned about, say, the way cats smell, the way they orient themselves in the world, the way they grow up, the way they perceive the world. I could bring this stuff to the public and hopefully really help people understand better how to relate to their cats and have their cats have better lives. And one thing in particular, I think most, and probably the most important thing in the book, comes from a study that was actually published in 1988, came from a conference in Switzerland in 1986. Paper written by a woman named Eileen Karsh, a psychologist from Temple University, who discovered that kittens need to be handled by humans, that is, you know, petted and kissed and just, you know, held in the lap and so forth, starting as early as 2 weeks of age, and when they are, and when they're exposed to sounds and disturbances of the children and car horns and vacuum cleaners and all that sort of thing, as they gradually grow older as very young kittens, they turn out to be fantastically well-adjusted, calm, friendly, non-aggressive cats. And that goes against almost everything that has previously been believed about raising kittens. Most people don't pay any attention to them at all until they're 7 weeks, and they're often adopted way too young. And so they grow up nervous and often maladjusted.
Although there is still a range of behaviors based on personality, in the same way that you could have two children of the same parents raised the same way with different personalities.
Absolutely, yeah. There's a lot of individual variation. But it, just as with children, human children, you get a much better break if it has some really comfortable and steady childhood.
So do you find there are a lot of things that we could talk about, but I just wondered if you find, like when you talk to people, I assume most of the people who come to this book are by nature interested in cats. You know, there's a sort of self-selection of people buying cat books, I would presume. And when you talk to people who have read the book, what are they most surprised by, or what do they most want to talk to you about as cat people?
Well, I think there are an awful lot of people who, even when they've had cats for years, don't recognize the emotional depth and intellectual complexity of cats. There's a lot going on inside cats that people just miss. People say they're aloof. People say they're just so shy, and they're not interested in people. Well, that's not true. You have to cultivate them. You have to learn to understand them. They don't communicate like dogs, just, you know, all goo-goo-eyed and trying to please you all the time. But there's a fantastic amount that can be learned when you learn to recognize cat language, and which is can be body language and other sorts of signals. You can actually learn to understand their vocalizations ultimately if you pay close enough attention. There's a fantastic depth, especially emotional depth. You know, cats can be tremendously rewarding companions, capable of complex and deep love. And a lot of people have not understood that about cats, even when they have had cats for all their lives.
Yeah, I was struck by, you know, your discussion about purring, you know, which I think a lot of people have misinterpreted or just don't even understand what it is. But I noticed that you said that when cats are purring for food, there's a difference in the tonality at the end of the purr than there is in other circumstances. I thought that was, so, I mean, theoretically, if you observe cats and really try to be sensitive to them, you might be able to understand them, you know, what they're saying. But, and I would presume that that works the other way around too, that the cats are attentive to their people, and are trying to interact with them, in their own way to figure out how to get what they need.
Exactly. I mean, one of the great studies that I drew on for the book was actually published a long time ago, 1944, by a woman named Mildred Mulk, who studied her three cats' vocalizations extensively and was able to learn the very subtle gradations between, for example, different kinds of meows that represented fearful hesitation versus uncertain hesitation. You know, and she could pick these things out, and I don't know, she had dozens of different gradations of vocalization that she learned to recognize in her cats, and they're with absolute accuracy, because you can always figure out what they're saying by what actions follow the vocalization, you know. And one of the ways that she was able to work this up to such a degree of subtlety was by talking back to the cats. So if the cat would give a little kind of a trill, she'd give the trill back. And eventually, as the cat and she talked back and forth to one another, she began to recognize subtle differences in the vocalization and then would be able to coordinate that with an action. And then in turn, once she developed this vocabulary, as it was, she was able to compare that with other people around the world who were studying the same kind of things and worked out a kind of a general universal vocabulary for cats. Although what's also interesting about this is that when you start to develop the really fine subtleties of communication with your cat, you're going to develop a kind of dialect that might not be the same as the one that develops between your next door neighbor and her cat.
Yes, I noticed that, I've come across that described in another book somewhere, that that cats are kind of, I mean, even though they're not as individuated as dogs are, you know, dogs sometimes really they become one person dogs, where cats are not necessarily one person cats, but the communication between cats is dialectic. You know, there's a dialect for a cat with its owner.
Absolutely. I mean, I'm sitting here now looking at my cat, Isabel. She's got this little donut bed on the side of the desk here, and she's part Bengal, and Bengals have a different kind of a vocal range. And Isabel has one name for me and one for my wife. And when she greets me in the morning, she goes, and that's Tom. and when she sees Elizabeth, she goes, that's Elizabeth. she has a lot of different things to say under different circumstances that we've come to recognize. And I'm not sure that they would be the same, you know. I don't know where her litter mates are now, but they might be saying completely different things to somebody else.
Right. So that, this maybe goes to, you know, that was another thing that I was interested in, is a sort of history of domestication. And I think you pointed out that cats have been domesticated for a fairly short period of time compared to other animals, something like 5,000 years. And I was really thinking about, you know, the fact that of all of the animals that have been domesticated, cats are the ones that seem also least domesticated. Not only the shortest period of domestication, but the ones that are more fully wild and are able to, I mean, you could let a cat go in the wild and it will survive. Maybe dogs,
that's a little overestimated. I mean, I think a lot of domestic cats, if you let them go in the wild, they starve because they don't know what to do. But it is true that some people say they're not really domesticated at all. The behavior of domestic cats is very similar to that of their direct ancestor, the North African wild cat. And it may very well be that even though they've been living in human company for 5,000 years, their behavior hasn't changed very much during that time. They may have been living around the granaries and the barns and so forth, killing mice and so forth. And the kittens were probably playing with human children. But the idea of the lab cat sleeping on the hearth, that may be go back only a few hundred years.
Right.
And a lot of their behavior is exactly the behavior of their wild ancestors, you know, the scent marking and the territorial sensitivities. And, you know, the way a cat is, cats are fanatics about their litter boxes, you know, and that exactly corresponds to the way a wild cat marks its, what they call the midden, where they go to pee and poop, which is the center of their universe. And that's why people have a lot of trouble with cats in their litter boxes, because they're so sensitive to the scent and to the placement and to a lot of other things about their litter box. And that, and of course, when we see cats rubbing their chin on the sides of the door and the furniture or your leg, that's all about pheromonal communication, because their whole sensory orientation in the world has a lot to do with scent. They're actually much more sensitive to fragrances than dogs are. And they, the way cats communicate with one another has a great deal to do with scent, and we can't smell it. You know, you can, you know, your cat goes and rubs his face on the furniture leg, and then you go sniff it. You can't smell anything. But other
probably,
cats
probably
can.
A good thing that we can't smell.
Yeah, that's right. Well, yeah. In fact, if a cat, if your cat is not neutered, God help you, because especially a male will go squirting its pheromonal signals all over everything, and you can damn well smell that. You don't want to either.
No, that's true. Well, I was thinking about the this whole domestication thing as, you know, trying to think about how different animals react in terms of communication with humans. And I guess I have felt that cats were fairly opaque, and that may just be because I have, you know, I'm not a cat person per se. It's not that I dislike them, but I've just never wanted to spend a lot of time with them. Maybe I'm allergic to too many of them or something, but they seem to be less communicative in a, and maybe less subservient in a basic way. Now, and that could be a misinterpretation, but I wondered what you thought about that idea.
Well, there is the old saying, you know, how does it go? Dogs have masters, cats have staff. Yeah, they're not subservient, that's for sure. But they're not opaque. They're just, let's say they're translucent. You have to look through their apparent opaqueness, and they will tell you a lot. You just start, for example, by learning to understand their body language, the way their ears move. I mean, your ears can tell you 20 different emotions right there. The tail can tell you 20 more. The whiskers can tell you 10 more. The eyes, the opening, the, you know, whether it's slit-eyed or there's a long, slow blink that means, I trust you. Mm. And then there's the quick flick of the tongue, which says, howdy. And there are, and there are various gestures with the body. There's a sort of beautiful long bow where the cat stretches its front legs forward and the head down. That is a kind of a, another friendly greeting. And on and on and on. Once you learn, can learn the basic body language, then you realize the cat can tell you a great many things, including annoyance and you know, various preferences. You know, they have a pretty wide range of things to say.
Right. You mentioned the guy Jackson Galaxy, who you know, seems to be able to communicate with cats at a level that no one else really seems able to do.
Yeah. And the thing is, though, I mean, once you watch him at work, he's got a TV show and he's got a website and all these things, you can learn from him to do the same thing. And it's, and in many cases, it's really just a matter of paying attention. You just watch. And you begin to realize that there are all these different things that they will tell you. And when once they start to succeed, you know, once the cat will say, you know, this is what I want here, you know, this cat, Isabel, for example, will come up and when she's hungry, she'll actually come up and sort of bite me. Not, she doesn't really bite me, but she opens her mouth and clamps down on my hand as though to say, come on, you know, take me, come with me to the kitchen. And, you know, she'll walk 2 feet in front of me, just turning around every couple of feet to make sure I'm following her. And then she goes and stands in a certain way behind her bowl, very politely waiting to be fed. And then she has various other behaviors that will tell you exactly what she has in mind to do. When we're in Montana, I go to Montana in the summer from San Francisco, where we are now. We have various walks that we go on, and Isabel can tell me exactly which walk she wants to go on, and she takes me out for a walk.
So you have a cat that lives indoors, principally in a city part of the year.
Well, she lives outdoors. She has outdoors here too. We have a little tiny backyard, and she goes out, and she goes actually over into other people's backyards, and I'm not quite sure what she does. I have a little tiny camera that I'm supposed to be able to mount around her neck. I'm supposed to have this harness that you put around her body, and you put this tiny little digital camera mounted on the harness. But every time I put the harness on her, she just falls on her side like she's been shot dead. So I've yet to be able to do this. And I also have a GPS tracking device, same thing, but I haven't been able to get her to cooperate with me.
Oh, God. I was just wondering how a cat that is a city cat adapts to being in a place like Montana. That just seems really amazing.
Oh, she loves it. And I mean, of course, they're in danger. I mean, both city and, you know, luckily, in both places, she's in a safe setting. The San Francisco setting, we live in a block that's enclosed entirely, so she can't get into the street at all. I mean, I think if you live near a busy street, you really shouldn't let your cat out because they're not that smart about streets. And in Montana, I know it's a risk. I mean, Augusta grew up in Montana with bears and coyotes and eagles. We really lived in way out in the boonies, 5 miles from the wilderness area. And Augusta actually learned to get along with bears. I once saw her out walking with some other bear and some cubs. The main thing is to keep them in at dawn and dusk and never let them out at night. Cause that's when the real danger is around.
Predators like owls and coyotes.
Yeah, exactly. And coyotes are always on the prowl at dusk and dawn. During the daytime, she can see something coming, run up a tree. Nothing's ever happened. But the only thing that ever happened to Isabel is she was attacked by raccoons here in San Francisco. It bit a chunk out of her tail. Hmm.
Well, it's a really, you know, for even for me, who not being necessarily all that enamored with cats, I found this to be a really interesting book, and I liked the way you constructed it. It's sort of, strictly, a kind of instruction manual for how to keep, you know, how to take care of cats or how to be a cat owner. It's much more interesting than that, I would say. So,
Thank you. I wanted it to be a story, you know, so that, you know, you could follow the story and then learn a lot rather than just be a book where you look something up.
Yeah. No, I think you've succeeded in that. And it's kind of interesting to get an understanding of your relationship with animals, but also you communicated a tremendous amount of information about cats. We didn't even talk about feral cats and, the difficulties that people have around the world in terms of controlling, the number of cats that exist in the world, which is pretty much a huge number.
It's a big problem, and it's growing numbers all over the world, and they do a lot of harm. And they also suffer a lot of harm, by the way. Being a feral cat is not a good deal.
No, I'm sure it's not. But it's also, that even the non-feral cats, the other issue is, the number of birds they eat, and then, the species that have been that they've outcompeted in places like Australia.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's, there are issues, I think, not just for feral cats, but just because we have so many of them.
Yep.
But obviously, there's a lot of love in this book, and I think a lot of, personal, the personal relationship with the animals is very powerful and kind of is the central focus of the book. It kind of overcomes all of those other issues. So that definitely came through.
I'm glad.
Well, thank you, Tom. I really enjoyed talking to you about this book. It's called The Inner Life of Cats, The Science and Secrets of Our Mysterious Feline Companions. I'm David Wilk. This is Writer's Cast, a podcast about books and authors. I've been talking to Tom McNamee.